Hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. Thank you for being here. It's a Wednesday. Those traditionally, always, are big news days. And so we're very lucky to be joined once again today by J.R. Jackson. How's it going, J.R.?
What's up? What's up? What's up? Big news Wednesday.
They are big news Wednesdays. We have breaking news that we're going to be talking about in just a little bit. I am like desperately scrolling through our archives for some elements that we would really like to have for this, but it's Google Docs, so it's taking forever. So we'll see if I get to that. But anyway, thank you for being here, everybody. In addition to the breaking news, and you know exactly what we're talking about, we're also going to be closing out the show today with Meanwhile In News from around the world that JR is going to be joining me for. We've got a big block that we need to do about this storm and some of the right-wing misinformation that's going around in relation to that. We have Tucker Carlson effectively just admitting what his entire thing is, as well as spinning a new really sick fantasy about Joe Biden's love life. We've got stuff on the minimum wage. We've got Joe Biden, his town hall was somewhat problematic. So we've got a lot. JR, how are you feeling about the news today?
As usual, I think we got a lot we can go through.
We do. I am like desperately scrolling and I'm still like a month off. Thanks, Google Docs.
The thing is, John, anyway, I understand where you're going with this and why you would like it, but everyone's heard it, I think everyone's.
I know it's not necessary, but we're gonna see what we can do. Anyway, I'm mostly vamping for time, so I can keep scrolling. Thank you everybody for being here, regardless of where you are. We really appreciate you joining us. Please hit the like button and share the stream if you haven't already so that people know we're live and it feeds the algorithm and we get the biggest community possible going on here. That would be great as we go through this news. And as we go through it, if you want to send us comments, tweets, super chats, anything like that, that would be absolutely great. We'll respond to you if you have any questions, maybe on this particular news day, if you have any concerns that you want to express that I can read on the show, actually. So be careful. That would be great too. We'd really appreciate that. But with that, I think I've vamped for as long as I can, and I'm only like a day off of this stuff. So we're gonna see what we can do there. Why don't we? Sorry, JR, what were you gonna say?
No, just you said you're a day off. You're close.
I am definitely okay. Everyone, hold. Hold, we're gonna see. Anyway, whatever, I'm gonna find it while we do this. So why don't we launch into this news? Breaking news this morning, Rush Limbaugh described in the news as incendiary radio host for multiple decades has passed away at the age of 70 after a bout with cancer. And JR is with me today. JR, obviously anyone dying is sad, cancer is the literal worst. And nobody dies, especially from cancer, without leaving a number of people who are gonna be hurt by that, rightly or wrongly. So right. Obviously it's sad when someone dies, right, JR?
It's sad when someone dies. And I hope the family of the deceased finds comfort for themselves as they continue on for themselves.
Exactly.
I didn't know Rush Limbaugh, so today it's news because he was famous. That's why. And obviously this is a year after the Presidential Medal of Freedom, receiving that from Donald, everyone having the things that they say about what went on with Rush Limbaugh. But Rush Limbaugh made a name for himself for being exclusionary, for being a racist, for talking down on people, for attacking the least fortunate, the least powerful, and the most attacked people in our country. He was one of the ringleaders of that. He formed the mindset and many talking points for Republicans over the years. He was the kind of mouthpiece Donald Trump was for the past 4 years in the presidency, because he had that kind of platform. President Trump had that kind of platform that Rush Limbaugh kind of had for how many years? 30 years that he was doing his show. So he was one of the reasons and one of the pieces of this Republican approach to politics, a conservative approach to politics that that gave us Donald Trump. Let's keep it real. So the people who always said Donald Trump isn't the one bug of this whole thing, he's the feature, he's the one that they've always been. Because I always feel like people say, oh man, Donald Trump came and he's coming to destroy conservatives. Look at the way how brash he is. He's not a real conservative. He's doing this, and look at the racism that he's coddling. That's the way the Republican Party has been for quite some time. And yeah. Rush Limbaugh was one of the people who made it nice and palatable for people, regular folks out there listening to him, the millions of people who listen to him, to feel comfortable with those feelings and to feel actually aggressive in those feelings. And yeah. Donald Trump just got into the position to amplify them further. That's really all this is. That's the reason why this conservative media is helpful to people, the politicians like Trump, is because it gives more of a spread of their information to the folks that maybe he wouldn't have reached because they trusted Rush Limbaugh. That's who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, like when people say that Trump says the things they think, a lot of the things they think because Rush Limbaugh said them, honestly. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we did what we're supposed to do. Now let's be real about all of it. There, every time someone dies who's in the public eye and is a controversial figure, we have this national conversation or just people disagree about how are you supposed to respond to it. And there are some people who think no matter what a person did, no matter who they were, what they said, what they advocated for, the choices they made, we should all be really nice and pretend they were someone else when they died. And if you believe that, I understand it. Death is a serious thing, obviously. I think that bundled up in that sort of evaluation is our own views of how we'd like to be remembered when we die. And none of us are perfect. That is certainly true. That said, we keep it real about everything, and so we're gonna keep it real about these people too, especially, and this is really a special case. It is one thing to be a certain person, but if the only reason we know who you are is because you are that person, if you made your fortune being that person, not just saying things as a private citizen, but being very well compensated to say certain things, then we get to talk about that. And we get to talk about who they are. And we get to talk about who Rush Limbaugh is. Because Rush Limbaugh was an aggressively awful person. That is the only reason anyone ever listened to him, is because he hated the people other people hated. And he gave them license to engage in not a 2-minute hate, but a 3 to 5 hour hate. I'm gonna talk about how bad black people are, so that you can listen to it, because you'd love to be in conversations about how bad black people are, but maybe society's made that too difficult. So I'm just gonna demonize them for you. And I'm gonna do that about women, I'm gonna do that about Muslims, I'm gonna do that about liberals, I'm gonna do that about women, everyone. I'm going to hate those people and make it cool for you to hate them too. And that's what he did, and he made millions of dollars doing it. I've got more, including specifics, but JR, you don't feel obligated to engage in any of this, but.
No,
that's
okay.
Who he is. So,
and sometimes the obvious nature of these types of figures has to be explained out the way that you're having to right now. So when someone is espousing hate over and over again and speaking to millions and millions of listeners, that normalizes the approach that they carry in every aspect of their life. Yes, they'll listen to 2 to 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh being a hateful radio personality, but then they go off and Miss Simpson is a teacher, and she teaches third graders. And then she approaches the way that she teaches children and the things that have been coddled and galvanized by people like Rush Limbaugh. Then she goes in and she mistreats some students. We talk about all the time how teachers in their approach to students, and even from the top to the bottom, from maybe some business owner listened to Rush Limbaugh, and then his hiring practices were formed around those beliefs. Yeah, then you disenfranchise people. Maybe a doctor listened to Rush Limbaugh, and his approach, the way that he deals with his black patients, was different. This thing changes the way people's mindsets are, and then they're in every profession. We were surprised when we saw people at the Capitol insurrection, like, oh man, they're business owners. Man, some of them are lawyers, some of them are doctors. Oh man, they're accountants. Yes, they come from every level of professional life. All these professionals and people in all these aspects of life, there's plenty of racism, people that like to build up this type of thought process behind the way that they approach every part of their life. It's why when people say, why you bring up race every time? Because race is always brought up to us. Mm-hmm. If we just want to point out how it's affecting us, and you said, how dare you keep talking about it? Well, Rush Limbaugh talked about it for decades, and he made sure that your mindset was a certain way. And that, honestly, it was a detriment to society. Let's keep it
100. Like, if there are of the bad things about American society, obviously none of all of that can be traced back to one person. But I think he has a bigger claim than the vast majority of people for why we're so tribal and small and hateful and xenophobic and completely avoidant of critical thinking or self-analysis. conspiratorial and just hateful and fearful. And it's not just that Rush Limbaugh was that way and that he gave people a show of that. He made people more like that. He made tons of people want to be like him in right-wing media. There are people just doing impersonations of Rush Limbaugh, and that's their whole career. And they still are doing it, even though he was on radio or whatever. That's what he was. And it wasn't just he was that way 50 years ago. Personally, I think that would be bad enough. He was awful up until he died, telling people that the coronavirus was the common cold. Okay, when you use your platform to get people killed, we're not gonna be super kind to you when you die. We're not gonna pretend that it's a national tragedy. It is a tragedy on a personal level, like it is when anyone dies, including the people who probably died because they believed misinformation about the coronavirus that was given to them by people like Rush Limbaugh. And really fast, I know that JR thinks this is pointless, like that we would remind people of the horrible things that Rush Limbaugh said. And certainly we could just do that for months straight, but like when he was saying that Susan Fluke was a slut, that she was paid to have sex when she testified before a congressional committee, or claim that Kamala Harris is not a person of color, or that Michelle Obama needs to get over slavery, that the New Zealand mosque shooting was a false flag, that, oh God, the stuff about Matt Lauer, I don't even want to engage with that.
Let's see.
In 2011, while the president of China was speaking, he said Hu Jintao was just going ching cha, ching chang, cho chow, cha chow, ching cho, chi ba ba ba. That was what he said on his show. And that is just, that is the merest smattering of the whole, like that was his, you could go and for 3 hours, it would be horrible, racist, misogynistic stuff. That is who he was. That is all that he was. And thankfully, while there's a lot of people whose reputation will be rewritten, and maybe there's a little bit of that going on today, everybody's going to remember who he was because that's all he was, and he was that way for a very long time.
Yeah, if I see headlines calling, you know, talk radio icon, and honestly, it's a stain on that profession that's an icon in that business. That business sucks. That type of person can be an icon, or society sucks because that person can be an icon in a business that spreads that kind of information, those kind of sentiments to so many people. That's an icon. And by the way, he was, because that's what humans made him. Yeah. Because humans believe that same stuff he does. There's a lot of work to be done in our society because instead of us, you know, now fighting over, oh, was he a good guy or a bad guy? Oh man, look, he was on my side, but he wasn't on your side. The society needs to fix itself and find out why after those 5 things that you point out that he has done and said doesn't come with 100% disgust from people. Mm-hmm. That if you say that to someone who's a supporter of this guy, that they won't go, man, that's disgusting. I really regret ever thinking a positive thing about that guy. The same way that many of them react when you say, hey, so what do you think about David Duke? For some reason, that line for a majority of them doesn't get crossed because he's solidified as a racist icon. When honestly, mm-hmm. Rush Limbaugh potentially has more of a racist icon background than David Duke does.
If David Duke was more popular, maybe, I mean, look, Tucker Carlson, people don't really identify what he is. We try. Because he has a lot of people who view him. Donald Trump, we have to debate whether he's a racist. When they become popular enough, the horrible things that they've said and done suddenly don't seem to count anymore. And we're trying to make sure that they count. And not just about him, but in general, like I tweeted, if you want people to be nice to you when you die, make choices that lead to that. I believe in incentives, and I think that falsely pretending that people were angels when they die provides a horrible set of incentives while they live. If you want your legacy to be great, be great. If you want people to say that you are nice and kind and empathetic and all of that, maybe do those things every once in a while. That would be my advice to you.
And let's keep it real. Okay, whether you believe in afterlife, God, heaven or hell, or any of that stuff, whether you're an atheist or a believer in any kind of religion, across all those lines, the deceased aren't really worried about what you're saying right now.
That's also true.
So, and this, again, that crosses all of them. So, anything that you have to say about who Rush Limbaugh really was today, it's only affecting other folks that are listening to it and other folks that maybe want to be him. So if our general idea of who this guy was is looked down upon because we don't want to continue to cultivate more of these type of people, we don't need to celebrate the things that he did and said. Why? Just because he was here?
Yeah.
There's exactly. been plenty of people here that say and do horrible things. Why aren't we honoring all of them?
Yeah, that's true.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today. And get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Mark, you saw what happened in Texas overnight. Millions left without power. People died. And it seems pretty clear that a reckless reliance on windmills is the cause of this disaster.
Okay, so that's a lie. It's a known lie. He knew he was lying while he said it. It's insane to say that the death toll, let alone the power being out across Texas and other parts of the country, people are still dealing with this as we're filming this, was a result of windmills being frozen. But he is a liar. That's what Tucker Carlson does. And so that was the first big segment on Fox News about this theory that all of this is due to the Green New Deal, which hasn't even passed. And then immediately the next morning, coverage of the outages during the February 16th edition of Fox and Friends first ran into the chyron, Texas power issues blamed on frozen wind turbines. Well, yeah, your guy did it the night before. I guess that's true. Fox and Friends framed discussion of the outages around the question of whether this is, quote, what America would look like under the Green New Deal. And you gotta love that. When they look at what we have without a thing and say, that's what it would look like if we had the thing. Like the lines for food during the pandemic, this is what it would look like under communism. But we have it right now and it's capitalism right now. Those windmills are frozen, the natural gas places are frozen, everybody has no power. This is not, we don't have the Green New Deal, but it had taken off. And then throughout Fox News, you have things like this little screenshot, green energy disaster. Somehow frozen wind turbines worsen blackouts in Texas. They're at least backing off a little bit. Tucker Carlson said it caused it. They're just saying it made it a little bit worse. Well, look, it's not true. It's not remotely true, but that isn't stopping Fox News from inundating the media and especially virtually every right winger of the country in the idea that the reason things are so bad is because of green energy or the Green New Deal or something with AOC. Take a look at this video.
Casey just reported millions of Americans in the cold and dark say the lack of power is because of green energy policies and the vilification of oil, gas, and coal. The stuff that really keeps you warm. Coming up, we're looking out for you. The energy wars will focus in.
Okay. So yeah, millions of Americans are saying that. Well, potentially maybe millions of Fox viewers are saying that now after you told them it over and over and over again, not only on things like Tucker Carlson, but Harris Faulkner, that's just their news. That's just the news. But now the news on Fox in the morning, in the middle of the day is just playing and commenting on Tucker Carlson clips. It has become such a big part of it. It's obviously not true. And we're gonna go through the actual numbers and all of that, but JR, what do you think about this?
So just that last, starting off with that last clip. So it's, first off, this is, they're talking about Texas primarily because of the storm. What is it about Texas that makes people now suddenly believe that the Green New Deal has been implemented in Texas, where they like to talk about how conservative and anti-AOC like they are, and how anti-climate change that the people that they like to elect are? Like, now we're supposed to believe that this is some liberal bastion of climate appropriate energy production? Is that what we're supposed to believe is happening? Widespread all over Texas, the Green New Deal has been implemented solely in Texas, and that's the problem that's going on now. By the way, she also said this is due to that and attacks on natural energy, whatever term it was.
Vilification.
So vilification of natural energy like coal and oil and all that has made the winter storm destroyed turbines and have everything blow up. How is talking about natural gas and everything make that happen? It doesn't make any sense. But let's continue this war on anybody who has any kind of productive, progressive way to go about energizing our nation and keeping people warm in times like this. They're actually vilifying the old way, and that makes bad things happen. How does that work? Give me the step-by-step direction of how that works, how someone talking about how bad our natural gas situation is, how that destroys things when a storm comes. How does that work?
I mean, it's, look, we're gonna get into why the storm is as bad as it is, but it sort of makes sense that we're faced by a crisis. We have a solution proposed to the crisis. No. The solution caused the crisis, even though we haven't even done it, because causality works in reverse if that's gonna protect natural gas companies, coal companies, oil companies, and all of that. We're gonna show you more video, but really fast, just so that everybody understands. Although Tucker Carlson, who has a dozen producers, 20 producers, could have looked this up, said it was because of the turbines. As Bloomberg notes, the region's grid operator has made clear that power plants across all resources, that means of all different types of power generation, had tripped offline. And in fact, data from the grid operator shows that generation from wind farms has actually been exceeding the agency's forecasts in recent days. The Washington Post Energy 202 blog reported that Carlson and the Wall Street Journal editorial boards blaming wind energy for the grid's failure is misleading, adding that while Texas's capacity to generate energy from the wind is down, with some turbines seized up, most of the power generation offline during the cold spell was supposed to come from traditional thermal plants. And an official with the Electric Reliability Council of Texas said yesterday that 16 gigawatts of renewable energy generation, mostly wind generation, were offline, but nearly double that, 30 gigawatts, had been lost from thermal sources, which includes gas, coal, and nuclear energy. And overall, you're gonna have to, well, apparently you don't have to provide evidence to say that it was green energy. You could just say it. When you understand that at this point of the year in Texas, wind only comprises less than 1/4 of their actual energy mix. So the idea that that going down would cause all the problems doesn't make sense, especially when traditional coal, oil, natural gas is actually shutting down at higher rates. The largest source of electricity in Texas is natural gas. Then you have wind and solar, you have coal and nuclear. They're all suffering, and wind and solar aren't even suffering the most, but all of that is inconvenient. You would need to actually care about the truth to dispatch your massive production team to find that out. Well, but John, I'm sure it's just an honest mistake, JR. Yeah. Tucker Carlson, sure, we disagree with him on some things, but he's just a good faith actor, you know? He makes mistakes from time to time. This isn't a purposeful lie that has now taken over Fox News to get people to not trust the Green New Deal. He's just a good faith actor.
That's all. And by the way, John, you did miss this segment. He came on later and he had an expert come on and talk about the makeup of the energy production and distribution within the state of Texas. He was also there to point out the fact that Texas is like the leading, what is it? The leading producer of all this kind of energy in the United mm-hmm. States. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the first thing you think about when this is traditionally what people say about Texas and like the oil rigs and everything? There was a team called the Houston Oilers in the National Football League because Texas is known for its oil production.
Mm-hmm. Whether it's
true or not, that's what they're known for. So now suddenly the Green New Deal has taken over Texas. Man, how did Ted Cruz let this happen? How did Governor Abbott let this happen? These guys are failures. I thought that they weren't progressives. Apparently, they've been on board with the Green New Deal this whole time. By the way, remember at the beginning you talked about these predictions about what the world will be like. The presidency under Biden, fires, riots. Green New Deal, apparently, this is what the Green New Deal would look like. But at the same time, they also point out how they have no idea how the Green New Deal would work. Again, you can play both sides of the game as much as you want, but you can only fool the people who just want to listen to what you have to say. They talk about how complicated and ridiculous the Green New Deal would be, but now they know how it works. I thought you didn't know how it would work and how it could possibly be implemented and have any kind of effectiveness.
It doesn't have to work. Because it's already responsible for Texas, even though it hasn't been passed. It's just, it's whatever you want. Actually, you know what? Let's move on to this next video because I believe that it's actually gonna be demonstrated here. Sean Hannity picked up the lie about the frozen turbines being responsible for what's going on in Texas. And he had the governor on, and this is their interaction.
Question is, if they have these rolling blackouts and you got freezing weather, I mean, and they're not reliable, and it's use it or lose it, what good is it?
Sean, this shows how the Green New Deal would be a deadly deal for the United States of America. Texas is blessed with multiple sources of energy, such as natural gas and oil and nuclear, as well as solar and wind. But you saw from what Trace said, and that is our wind and our solar got shut down, and they were collectively more than 10%.
Okay, so again, supposedly 10% was supposed to be responsible for all of this. I love, by the way, that he was just waiting for Sean Hannity to stop talking so he could do his Green New Deal would be a deadly deal line that he was evidently very proud of. And I don't think it's particularly clever. And even he says, see, he knows the distribution of how they generate power. He knows that wind and solar aren't large enough to be responsible, even if they were failing at the rate of the others. And he's there bragging about how they get their power from a bunch of different sources, but this is just too convenient. And even in the intro, before we played that, Sean Hannity said, no, I want you to understand, I'm an all of the above type of guy. I want there to be solar and wind, but this lie is too appealing. And so I'm gonna have you on and we're gonna lie about what's actually causing this. Not just because we want to protect oil and gas companies, but also they failed in Texas. That governor failed, and people have already died in Texas as a result of that failure. And we want to distract people from that. We want them thinking about how this is Al Gore's fault and AOC's fault, maybe Nader or something, but certainly not the people actually in charge of weatherizing the generation of power in Texas. And understanding, by the way, that those things were made for a certain range of temperatures. There are wind turbines north of Texas that operate in freezing temperatures. Why do those operate, but not the ones in Texas? Because the ones in Texas aren't supposed to have to deal with those extreme temperatures, but they do because of climate change. Their solution would be to stop using those things, go even more into gas and oil and coal and natural gas and all of that, which would make the problem even worse. And again, it's causing those to fail too. So they want to double down on what is literally failing even more and would make the problem worse anyway.
Never ignore when leaders of a certain group, or specifically politicians, what their response is to something like this. Yes, no one brought in this particular winter storm that's hitting the South like crazy. It's a natural thing that happened, right? Now, yes, we have some effects, potentially climate change, all that stuff. But if a winter storm hits and it affects all of these systems, if your leadership doesn't look at the problem and say, how can we fix this and how can we make sure it doesn't happen again? Or how can we at least be better prepared for it? It could be as simple as drainage when rain comes, you know, things like that where you're prepared for natural things that happen. If then your response is to start blaming other political initiatives instead of doing something about it, this problem will happen again. And in fact, the current problem will get worse. It's like what happened with Flint. When the problem was discovered with the water and the pipes and everything, which should have been discovered and addressed beforehand so that it wouldn't have happened. Once it happened, cover-ups start happening. Protection of your job starts happening. Political attacks on the other starts happening. Rather than doing your job and fixing what the problem is and even saying, we were unprepared for this, I promise you we're gonna be prepared now.
Yeah.
Because we already know that you were unprepared. We're looking at it and we're seeing people dying. We're seeing people suffer and trying to figure out what to do next. Now, if your response is, now I'm going to attack the other group that has some kind of other plan and then say, I didn't do anything. It was your fault that we never actually even implemented your plan. If that's your approach, pay attention because they're going to do it every time to you. And eventually, your constituents are going to be the scapegoats. It's your fault next. Trust me. As a matter of fact, with the city of Colorado City, Texas, that mayor, he already did blame the constituents. He blamed his residents and his citizens. It's your fault.
How dare you ask for help? Yeah, it's an, like, how do people not see through this? When California is ravaged by wildfires as a result of climate change worsening them, they say that it's the damn libs' fault for making all these changes that have to do with climate change. When Texas is devastated, it's the libs' fault, even though Texas didn't make those changes. So it's either way, whatever it is, it's AOC's fault. Doesn't matter where it happens or what happens, what the failure is. If it's from doing something, it's from not doing something, it's AOC's fault.
My last thought, John, sorry, last thought. Just the way America is run in general, you know, we're the weakest and the strongest country in the world. We have this military that can kick everybody around, but then we're afraid because people are gonna attack us. We're the richest and the poorest country in the world. And you know, we're so rich, we can do whatever we want, but we're so poor, we can't actually afford to do anything for the constituents and for the citizens that actually make up all of that money. As long as you can play that we're the strongest and the weakest, we're the best and the worst side at the correct times, you can just continue to retain your power, and that's all this is.
Yeah, it's like we were saying about Antifa. Like, Antifa are little nerds who live in their basement, and like you, like strong white patriots are so much stronger. Also, Antifa are super soldiers and they're gonna kill every cop in the country. It's like, it's whatever it needs to be. It's the best and the worst. It's the best of times, it's the worst of times for reality. Anyway, really fast, why is the storm so bad? Not because of the turbines, and weather is complicated, admittedly. But here is a climate specialist, Jeff Berardelli, who's gonna try to explain a little bit of what scientists think might be leading to these record-breaking low temperatures in the South of America.
We ought to talk about why this is happening. You know, we've been talking about this for weeks here on CBS This Morning, but the Arctic is warming, both for natural causes, a sudden stratospheric warming, but also because of climate change. Now, this is just a theory, but when climate change warms the Arctic, we think that it causes the jet stream to become floppy and wavy, and so the polar vortex escapes. And in this case, it has moved 4,000 miles from where it would typically be, right towards the beaches of the Gulf of Mexico. When you push Arctic air into the tropics like this, you're bound to cause problems. And one of the problems that you cause is the fact that it's clashing with very warm, very humid air, and a lot of wind shears twist and turn in the atmosphere. And that's why we had that big tornado in the Carolinas. Well, that severe weather threat is going to be moving west as we head into Wednesday and Thursday.
Yeah. So, and like that's, I understand that the level that most right wingers, I'm not even talking about like the right wing media who aren't going to engage at all about what's actually, because they don't care, they're not interested. But their viewers will be like, well, you said it would get hotter. Okay, I understand that people talked about global warming and that seems as if it's some sort of universal thing. No, climate change will cause many problems. It is upsetting a variety of different natural balances and that has a lot of effects. Some places will be wetter, some will be drier, some will be colder, some will be hotter. It's going to change a lot of things. A lot of them are not going to be great for humans, basically. And so, yes, it can lead to drier areas in California that worsen wildfires. And it can also lead to incredibly cold temperatures in Texas and other states across America. Understanding that could potentially lead to policy changes that might make those storms less terrible in the future. Just saying squirrel turbines is not actually going to help anyone.
Because that's the argument. You give those details of how this actually works, a meteorologist or a scientist will point out specifically how it works, but the opposing argument will then be, but that doesn't make any sense, but what about snow? Like, it's ignoring the obvious nature of the explanation and just going, you know, it was really hot last summer. It was just so cold though. You don't have to say why, you don't have to say what situations brought that on, which what that guy was just pointing out, which I didn't know. I don't know how that works, it's not my job. But then if you, who doesn't have that job, go, but there was snow, and then you have this, I got you point. That's the people. That's the argument that we're having.
Yeah,
they're getting us nowhere.
Last night, Joe Biden had his first town hall as president, and a number of topics came up, some of which we might return to on tomorrow's show. But first, we wanted to talk about student loan debt and loan cancellation, which Biden has been in favor of, although not to the level that many activists want. Here he is talking about that at last night's town hall.
Loans are crushing my family, friends, and fellow Americans.
Me too.
The American dream is to succeed, but how can we fulfill that dream when debt is many people's only option for a degree? We need student loan forgiveness beyond the potential $10,000 your administration has proposed. We need at least a $50,000 minimum. What will you do to make that happen?
I will not make that happen. It depends on whether or not you go to a private university or a public university. It depends on the idea that I say to a community, I'm going to forgive the debt, the billions of dollars of debt for people who have gone to Harvard and Yale and Penn and schools, my children. I went to a great school. I went to a state school. But is that going to be forgiven rather than use that money to provide for early education for young children who are come from disadvantaged circumstances? That we should be eliminating interest on the debts that are accumulated. Number one, and number two, I'm prepared to write off the $10,000 debt, but not 50.
Mr. President, let me ask you.
Because I don't think I have the authority to do it by sign of the pen.
Okay, so, I mean, look, JR, he was at least honest. He said, I'm not gonna do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not gonna make it happen. And there's more there. I'm gonna give you first.
Yeah, I'm a little confused at because this when I read it, I was like, I need to see how he said this, because the way that it was written was that he's not willing to do $50,000 of school of student debt to eliminate, but he's willing to jump on board for 10 because he doesn't think he can do 50 from the stroke of a pen by signing an executive order, mm-hmm. whatever process he may go through. Does that mean he can do it for 10? Because that's what it seems like he's saying. I'm not sure if that's what he means to say.
That's what it seems like.
So again, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I'm not I don't know every aspect of the way that all these orders would work. But is there a limit? So at 10,000, you can, because is that written somewhere? But if it gets $10,000 and $1,
the Constitution,
then that means you can't do it by the stroke of your pen.
Well, I mean, he has to be talking about executive orders, because anything could be done through legislation. Mm-hmm. So he seems to think there's something I can do, but not so much. I'm trying to like play devil's advocate. What could he possibly be talking about? And I'm coming up blank. Now, maybe I'm just ignorant or dumb. I don't know. That's possible. It's happened before. Or he just doesn't want to do it, and this seems like a convenient out that I can't do that by the stroke of a pen. No, you have every bit as much authority. The authority is vague and has been used broadly in other areas for bad stuff, sure. But if you're saying you're gonna do this, but there's some dollar amount, okay, well, then what is it? Is 10,000 the most that you falsely think you have the legal authority to do as president? Or could we get 11,000? Maybe 14,000? Do I get thrown in jail if I say 17,000? What exactly is the cutoff point? Because there is a wide range between 10 and 50. And in that range, I would say dwell millions of Americans whose hopes and dreams are being crushed under this debt. So maybe it's worth us thinking a little bit about and seeing how much help we can actually provide. Because Chuck Schumer even seems to think you can do way more than 10,000, let alone education activists. People who are trying to get this cleared. So why do you think that? And by the way, he cannot just adjudicate this on town halls responding to a question. If this is his defense, then he needs to provide actual evidence, or he needs to be corrected. And if he can't be corrected, then he needs to be attacked by other Democrats pointing out that he is lying when he says 10,000 is the cap. It isn't, and it matters. 15,000 would help a lot more, 25 far more than that. I've had student loan debt. I'm thankfully free of it now, but there are millions and millions of Americans who desperately need this aid, and him sort of just cavalierly saying, nah, that's as much as I think I can do, is just not acceptable when there's so much at stake.
Yeah, so this is also the way certain kinds of Democratic politicians feel comfortable with Republicans still having this level of power that's close enough to holding it. They can blame them for the reasons that they agree with them. I'm not going to do that. I can do 10,000, so I can still sound like I'm all actually for some kind of student debt relief. Mm-hmm. But I can't do 50 because we got to send that to Congress. And we know what's going to happen in Congress, or at least in the Senate for sure. They're going to be against it. So I tried, you guys. I tried. Now, if there's too much of a democratic control over these branches of government, then they have to do something, or they have to be honest, openly honest, completely, and say, yeah, you know what? We can do it. And we can even do it through Congress. But I just don't want to. It would have to get to that point. And if you get to that point, you just look bad. So we're like, we need to keep some semblance of a Republican Party here and not completely decimate them so that we can lean on them as being the bad guys when they are.
Yeah.
But we are actually agree with them on these bad decisions. That's what they still need them for. That's why Nancy Pelosi said she wants a strong GOP. A strong GOP means just strong enough that we can leave them there, that when we agree with them, which is a nice percentage of the time, it can be just their fault. When they're all bad.
Jer, we just got a comment, and I'm not gonna name the person. You know, I love people give us feedback, and it says in all caps, give them a break. It's a pandemic and a recession. No. And you know what? I'm not going to specifically because it's a pandemic and a recession, which I've looked into it affects people other than Joe Biden and affects them in a way that being crushed under tens of thousands of dollars of student loan debt is actually worse for them. He's the president. He's going to be okay. He's wealthy. He's going to be just fine. But people who have been suffering in this terrible economy that are being crushed by a BMW worth of student loan debt, they need help. And his ability to sign an executive order isn't, as far as I can tell, affected in any way by a pandemic. In fact, I would say it's a great justification to do it, rushing aid to people who need it most. But I want to ask you a question, JR, because he referenced in there, it depends what school you went to. We don't want to be canceling debt for people who went to Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
What do I care where someone got their education?
Again, you know what that
is? What does that matter?
It's making it seem like you're the everyday guy. And you know, all the rich and elitists went to Harvard because that's the thought process and the illustration we have in our head of the type of folks who go to Harvard. I've never been to Harvard. I went to USC, which I think probably has a similar feel because there's a lot of rich kids that go there. And there's a lot of kids, by the way, that aren't rich that went to USC that actually got by because there's like, there's a prestigious school, there's a way that I can get ahead. I will accumulate this debt in order to get ahead because that's what's basically been promised to me. Yeah. If I get this education, I'm in. What do I have to worry about? Yeah, $90,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 worth of student debt. Who cares? I'm going to be making millions. You know what school I went to? I went to Harvard. Yeah. So there's not just all these rich kids. Yes, there's plenty, and they'll pay their own way, whatever they wanted to do with Harvard or any of these other schools, Stanford, all of them. But there's plenty of kids that go there who were told, you go here, you're now on the level of what we always called the Harvard and Stanford and USC and all those kids. Mm-hmm. And it's not always the case. In fact, most times it's not.
Yeah, what if it's a kid who grew up poor and did really well in his tests, got a scholarship or whatever to go to Harvard? No, screw you, because you went to Harvard? That doesn't make any sense. Honestly, like, fake populism is way worse than no populism. Because it produces things like this, things like Tucker Carlson occasionally using the word ruling elites, but it doesn't mean anything. It's being used as a defense for the same old policies that benefit the rich, or even in this case, where what we're talking about is setting up new aid. If fake populism is being used to limit that aid as much as possible, I would rather that you just be honest about the fact that you are largely in favor of the financial gains going to the wealthiest people, because you're trying to make sure that less of it goes to those who actually need it. Mm-hmm. Anyway, like this hasn't been done yet. He could have done the 10,000 on day one. He hasn't even done that. So we're having this debate about numbers, but as of right now, the number's zero. He has done zero. Now, yes, they've stopped the interest and all of that. That's good. It's a pandemic after all, but it's still waiting for people later on. And as of right now, his position is indistinguishable from Donald Trump's position on canceling student loan debt from the point of view of someone who's actually being crushed by it.
And by the way, if he has an agreement with folks that think that there's some kind of a detriment on the economy, if you relieve this student debt, tell us that. If that's your belief, and then we can actually have a conversation about the realities of those situations, the economic discussions, what it'll actually do for people, what it'll do for the economy if they have that kind of money that maybe they were paying every month to student loan debt, or weren't paying every month to student loan debt, and going further and further into debt. And we're like, how come no one can buy any houses? Man, people's debt, they don't actually care about these things, but people are concerned this is what happens to their lives from the beginning.
Yeah.
It changes a lot.
And by the way, if what you're actually worried about is the possibility that a rich couple's kids will get aid, that already factors into the federal student loans that they're offered anyway. That's how it works. If your family has a lot of resources, you're not gonna be offered as much loans. That's already built into the system. Using it as a justification not help out people now is either ignorant or purposefully dishonest. Anyway, let's move on to our next study, which is actually somewhat related. Another thing that in theory could be passed almost instantly, but Democrats are choosing not to. Okay. Our country is having this national conversation about the possibility of raising the minimum wage either as part of the COVID aid package or shortly thereafter. And part of it has to do with whether it could be passed via reconciliation, which seems like based on CBO analysis should be adjudicated, but for some reason isn't. But actually, why don't we talk about another benefit that would come to the government if people were to be paid a $15 minimum wage? You need to understand that as of right now, when corporations like McDonald's or Walmart, for instance, pay poverty wages, workers often turn to public safety net programs to make ends meet. It's one of the ways that the government subsidizes this horrible anti-worker approach of corporate America. A new study from the UC Berkeley Labor Center finds that families of half the workers who would receive a pay increase under the proposed $15 minimum wage bill in Congress are enrolled in one or more public safety net programs at a cost of $107 billion a year. Which means that if these corporations actually paid people what they need to live so that they're not being subsidized by the government, then the government wouldn't have to subsidize it. And that means that a significant amount of money would then be saved by the federal government. We're talking about literally tens of billions of dollars. Now, I'm not saying that that's one of the biggest things that they're gonna consider about whether they should pass this or not. But especially if we're having some sort of conversation about whether this has an effect on the budget and thus should be able to be passed via reconciliation, I would say that tens of billions of dollars has a significant impact on the budget.
Yeah. And again, with this information, this is blatant, obvious information, you can make a political argument and start telling people the opposite of the lies that they've been told for so many years. Hey, you know what, everyone? Your taxpayer dollars are going to continue to sustain this $7.25 minimum wage. You are paying to get paid minimum wage. And if you're not making minimum wage, you're paying for other people to get paid minimum wage. Do you like that? Because we definitely told them for decades, how do you like paying for people to live off the government teat? Do you wanna pay for these quote welfare queens? That was pushed constantly and it still is. Let's not act like it stopped. We're paying for these people to live off of welfare. You know they have a cell phone. You know they actually have a refrigerator. All these arguments were made. I'm not making these types of arguments up, that we're paying for them to live off of the government. Well, now you're paying them to live off the government and sustain that low minimum wage. Does that make you happy? Do you feel good about that? That your tax dollars go to that? Because it should be said over and over and over again, because there's a study and there's reality behind the case that this is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, we occasionally will cover studies of, you know, what the actual impact of raising minimum wage is on employment and things like that. We like try to just take the great academic work that's being done in these areas, areas that directly bear on policy, potential policies, and just put it out there. I hope that people are integrating it. I honestly, I think that things like this, like I don't think that Republicans, and I'll include like Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin, who don't think it should be included in the COVID aid bill, are like seriously opposed to raising the minimum wage because they're worried employment's gonna go down by 3%, even though it's not. I really don't think that. I think it's just, it is an opposition to paying these people what they should be worth. It's the idea that it is a lesser thing. You are doing work that's not important. If it was important, you'd get paid more. And we really don't care. Sometimes they're more explicit about those arguments. Sometimes it's a little bit more hidden, but that I think is what's actually underlying it.
Yeah, and anytime someone's gonna complain about unemployment being a problem and small businesses going under, small businesses go under and unemployment is still a problem. Are we sitting at 1% unemployment or something? Is America the bastion of unemployment, of employed people in the world? Because we've got so many and everyone's on board and everyone's so damn happy. Is that what's really happening? Because you don't wanna change what's happening with the system? We're acting like we have this great system where everyone is thriving. And if we change it, everyone's going to be living on the streets, which is what we see more and more actually in our society.
Okay, with that, we are running low on time. We're going to just quickly do this story so that we have time for meanwhile in. We'll see what we make of this. Let's launch into it. Donald Trump is continuing his unprecedented streak of not appearing in public or speaking, which is much appreciated. Thank you to the former president. But with Mitch McConnell, the new Senate minority leader, attacking him over his impact on the Capitol attacks, even though Mitch McConnell did vote to acquit him, Donald Trump has put out a letter attacking Mitch McConnell. And we just want to read you a few of the highlights from it, and then why we think it's important, what we think this letter might represent. So he starts by saying the Republican Party can never again be respected or strong with political leaders like Senator Mitch McConnell at its helm. McConnell's dedication to business as usual, status quo policies, together with his lack of political insight, wisdom, skill, and personality, has rapidly driven him from majority leader to minority leader. It will only get worse. The Democrats and Chuck Schumer play McConnell like a fiddle. They've never had it so good. What? And they want to keep it that way. We know our America First agenda is a winner, not McConnell's Beltway First agenda or Biden's America Last. Well, JR, can we do a bit of a fact check on that America First agenda being a winner?
Yeah, it won in 2016 and it won in.
It lost.
Yeah. It lost. That's right. The Kansas City Chiefs just released a statement after the Super Bowl loss to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And they said, hey, our strategy going into that Super Bowl was obviously a winner.
it's their first down first agenda. It's definitely better. And like the idea that like McConnell's being played like a fiddle. McConnell so far has gotten everything that he wanted, considering he's the minority leader right now. All I want is like his attacks against McConnell are perfectly fine. I hate McConnell, but like I want people to honestly evaluate what is happening, who a person is, what they're trying to accomplish, the relationship between them and other political actors, because I really don't think that we can successfully run campaigns, advocate for policies if we don't get that stuff. And everybody thinks that everybody is something they're not, that Joe Biden's a communist, Joe Biden's trying to pass the Green New Deal. He doesn't even support the Green New Deal. Anyway, it all ties together, but there's a little bit of defense of his effect. We were talking about the America First agenda. He says, in Mitch's Senate over the last two election cycles, I single-handedly saved at least 12 Senate seats, more than 8 in the 2020 cycle alone. And then came the Georgia disaster, where we should have won both seats, but McConnell matched the Democrat offer of $2,000 stimulus checks with $600. How does that work? It became the Democrats' principal advertisement, and a big winner for them it was. Look, that's sort of true. Although Trump put out that statement about the $2,000, he never really seemed to care about it. He certainly didn't actually make it happen. And I love that it's like, I saved all the seats that we won, all the seats that we lost, that's you, buddy. That's a convenient way to look at elections.
So he looks at everything in life that he loses at. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm going to jump ahead because there's a lot here. But anyway, he's going to close with saying Mitch is a dour, sullen, and unsmiling political hack. And if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again. He will never do what needs to be done or what is right for our country. Where necessary and appropriate, I will back primary rivals who espouse making America great again and our policy of America first. We want brilliant, strong, thoughtful, and compassionate leadership. That's what he wants. This is a big moment for our country, and we cannot let it pass by using third-rate leaders to dictate our future. So
that's look, yeah.
Well, no, go.
This is obviously the beginning of the official divide of the Republican Party, and we knew this. We're saying Mitch McConnell was upset because Trump, nuclear bombed their chances in Georgia, so he's mad because that lost Mitch McConnell power. That's when you got him angry, right? Now they had their divisions. This is the official split. Mitch McConnell started with his speech after he voted to acquit, and now Trump is responding. So we'll see where it goes. As far as people wondering what the importance potentially of this, little looks like a cat fight is. This is now the Trump is saying either you're on my side or you're on his side. Whose side are you on? Now let's see where the lines, where the foot soldiers start landing, and where the Republican Party goes.
I mean, I think we know that. I think we know that. And we've been talking about this, that Mitch McConnell is probably fine. I mean, he just won re-election. Heads with Trump, Mitch McConnell actually won. You lost. Maybe Mitch McConnell sucks. I get it. And basically everything that Trump said about Mitch McConnell is true. He is dour and sullen, although Trump is pretty dour and sullen himself. But anyway, the future of the Republican Party and the sorts of campaigns they're going to be running, that does matter to everyone because we're going to be dwelling in that political reality. And whether the Republican Party comes out as the Mitch McConnell Party, which I can't imagine it will, or much more likely is either the Patriot Party as an actual third party, or it is so taken over the Republican Party that that's effectively what it is, that actually matters. And we can see it in real time. The completely dispensing with reality, that's driving the misinformation about the Green New Deal right now in regards to the storm. Like this complete divorcing of policy and ideology from having any respect whatsoever for the facts. That is a big thing, and it's almost certainly going to be the principal characteristic of the future of the Republican Party.
It's the only place they have left to go. Honestly, either you're for it or against it. And that's what Lindsey Graham is saying, and that's what these other guys that have fallen in behind Lindsey Graham are saying. We need to have a Donald Trump, and that's the only way we survive. And maybe they're right. My small last thing on this, because I thought it was awesome, and I'm glad you didn't know it. But there was apparently a person familiar with the crafting of this letter. And there was a previous draft. And I always think, what are the first drafts of Donald Trump's letters? Because he's probably standing there barking while someone writes. One person said that an early draft mocked McConnell for having multiple chins. And
what?
But Trump was convinced by advisors to take that part out. Let's keep it real. They said, quote, there was a lot of repetitive stuff and definitely something about him having too many chins, but not enough smarts. Is what the person was quoted to say, the line was supposed to say. Mitch McConnell's got all these chins, but no smarts. Oh, I wish it had stayed. I wish it would have stayed.
Again, divorced from reality and unable to see who you yourself actually are.
There's so much about that one thought process that is just fabulous.
I get it. And look, I know it's weird. Like some people will see this and be like, ha ha ha, they're fighting. I hate both of them. And for me, it's just, I don't like either of them. And they both suck. And they both have had a horrible effect on America. And one of them is going to come out on top. It's going to be bad for us either way. I think it's very important that we understand which it's going to be. But the current state of their leadership. The chin, I don't care about the chins, man. This is your leader. And Lindsey Graham was saying on Sean Hannity last night, they have zero chance of retaking the House without Trump, which is such an amazing admission of how content free their entire party is. Trump didn't even have a platform for his reelection as president. You think he's going to be choosing primary contenders based on their stance on the economy or infrastructure or something? It's just, it's politics that has nothing to do with politics, basically. And now it's time for news from around the world. And meanwhile, in India, the strike back against both the farmers protesters as well as anyone aiding those protesters continues, with an Indian activist sort of linked to Greta Thunberg being arrested. Delhi police confirmed the arrest of Disha Ravi, who's in her early 20s, in a tweet on Sunday that accused her of being a quote key conspirator in the document's formulation and dissemination. So this document is like sort of a toolkit for activism around these issues. It's unsigned, publicly available, provides a list of ways that supporters can help the ongoing protesters. But she apparently key conspirator, according to Delhi police. The joint commissioner of the police said the main aim of the toolkit was to create misinformation and disaffection against the lawfully elected government. That is an amazing sentence. Anyway, Ms. Ravi is also one of the founders of the local wing of Fridays for Future, a global movement begun by climate change activist Greta Thunberg. This toolkit was tweeted out by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. The police say the call was to wage economic, social, cultural, and regional war against India. No, it's just a document to help provide a little bit of aid, show solidarity with this protest movement. They're accusing her of sedition and conspiracy. Insane. Insane. Now, there are people defending Ravi. The chief minister of Delhi said that her arrest is an unprecedented attack on democracy. Supporting our farmers is not a crime. Well, that waits to be seen, but it shouldn't be. And thousands internationally have signed an online petition calling for her to be freed. She just like was sort of involved with this document, didn't create it. Even if they had, I can't see how that's possibly a crime in any way. So like, I feel like every time we touch base on this, it's the police going another step too far in their strike back against these protests.
That means they're potentially losing the public debate about what's going on there. Anytime someone who's spreading something that is widely already easily available to anyone else, it means that she's reaching folks. I'm not sure to what degree, but enough apparently to them become the reason why and then the main head behind this whole thing. And obviously she didn't create it. And even if she did, I'm not sure if that's an illegal act, but I doubt it.
Yeah, we're gonna see. I mean, imagine that this activist has gotta be terrified about what's gonna happen. But thankfully there is support being shown. I hope that with the international focus on this case as it goes forward, hopefully that will provide some help. Maybe the government will be a little bit more hesitant in what they do in regard to this if they know that everyone is watching. But it's absolutely horrific. There's nothing wrong with showing solidarity with people who are trying to organize for their economic rights. And hopefully people internationally will continue to support this.
Yep, half of it is to punish her, the other half is to make sure no one else becomes another one of her.
Maybe. Yeah, and with a lot of Indian celebrities, actors and things like that speaking out, it's also threatening to them. Do you want to tweet out links to websites if that could lead to you being accused of sedition and conspiracy? Anyway, meanwhile, in Afghanistan, at least 30 Taliban militants who had gathered inside a mosque to learn how to make bombs and IEDs are dead after a bomb went off during the class, according to an Afghan news agency. The death toll includes 6 foreign nationals who were expert mine makers, but their bodies could not be identified because the blast was so strong. The explosion comes during increasingly deadly Taliban violence in Afghanistan, including a Taliban IED that was responsible for killing 2 children. And the Taliban says it will continue its violence until United States troops are fully withdrawn from the country. I don't have a lot specifically to say about that, but that's crazy. And that sounds like the sort of thing that happens when you gather a whole bunch of people to make a bunch of IEDs. Bad stuff happens as a result of that.
Yeah, it's another aspect of how, I wonder how often this happens, first of all. I'm sure it's not completely rare when you're trying to put together loads of IEDs. I would think that this is probably a side effect of this kind of battle, war, confrontation for ideology. But you don't want to be the one to have to see something like that.
Exactly.
But I mean, it's not going to end anything. Where does the source of these problems have to be figured out before anything else happens? So seeing this and being like, yeah, it's over.
No, definitely not.
Where that came from.
Exactly, unfortunately. And it's sort of just a reminder like this little story. So it's February 17th, 2021. We've been there for 2 decades and we're still generating stories like this, where either those militants blow themselves up or they had taken the mines and the bombs that they created there and they would have killed countless people, some soldiers, some civilians, kids as well. Mm-hmm. That is a continued thing that we have in large part as a country created and sustained for more than 2 decades. People in that room died who are younger than the conflict they're dying in. Ugh. Anyway, meanwhile, Mexico is trying to fight an international battle to make sure that the distribution of vaccines becomes, I was gonna say equitable, but really just a little bit more equitable, because it is anything but. Now, we've been talking about this for some time. There are entire regions of the world that have had no doses of vaccine. I believe when we last talked about Africa, there was one country that had gotten 15, and that was about it for an entire region of the world where hundreds and hundreds of millions of people live. Well, now Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard told reporters yesterday that the Mexican delegation of the United Nations will file a complaint at the UN Security Council tomorrow concerning the inequality and inequity that he says impede vaccine access. Right now, Mexico has only managed to administer about 750,000 vaccine doses, although they've signed purchase agreements for the eventual delivery of more than 230 million doses. There's this program COVAX designed to increase the equitable access to the COVID vaccine internationally. They haven't begun distributing things, although they do plan, they announced plans earlier this month to distribute more than 35 million doses of vaccine across the region by the end of the second quarter, which still at that point, an entire region of the world would be way lagging behind countries like the UK, Israel, the US, other parts of Europe as well. So look, if this starts an international conversation about this, I get that people are feeling very insular and xenophobic. They feel like if they can get access to it, that's what's important. But there are a lot of people suffering in a lot of different parts of the world. And simply because the US has more money does not necessarily mean that they should get access to basically every dose in this hemisphere before anything goes south of the southern US border.
Sounds like the way we've always done things, honestly. It's why, you know, you tout the money and the power and the influence that we'd have is because how much have we thought about other countries, especially other countries that aren't like direct, what we see as direct allies, you know, like, oh, we get reports about, oh, what's happening in England? Oh, there's an outbreak in London. Oh my God, look what's happening in France. Look what's happening in Spain, you know, things like that. And so that will coincide with the way that we approach even getting beyond it, potentially some with this vaccine helping out. Why would we concern ourselves with these countries we haven't concerned ourselves with before? What is it they're going through? I don't know, it doesn't affect me. Let's put a travel ban on them or something so they can stay away from us. And then when we see destruction and devastation in other countries, then what we say is, man, look what's going on over there. They should get their act together.
Yeah, totally. And by the way, like, I mean, it should be obvious, but we're not safe until we're all safe. International trade still relies on not having pandemics spreading, you know, in all across the world. And not to mention the fact that if you leave entire regions of the world to wait 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years to get the vaccines, that is a breeding ground, not just for more COVID, as bad as that would be, but to spring forth the sorts of variants that have come internationally into the US recently that our vaccines won't necessarily protect against, or not at the same level that they protect against the original kind of COVID-19. So that should also be a consideration, that the faster we can get everyone vaccinated, the less of a breeding ground we have for dangerous, more transmissible variants of COVID to continue to flow around the world and inevitably into the US as well.
Yep. There's only a certain number of things that moats and walls can block you from, and this is one of those things that it can't.
Exactly. Well, JR, thank you as always for joining us for a truly big news Wednesday. Appreciate your contribution today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that this all went down on a Wednesday. Give me the opportunity to do such a thing.
Exactly. Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
See you.
Joining us once again on the program to break down the history of the current state of the farmers' protests ongoing in India is Washington Post journalist Sabrina Mali. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here, and especially on this topic. This is something that we've discussed several times on the show, but for a lot of American news consumers, it is news to them. So if you could catch us up, what's been going on in India? What was the origin of these protests?
Sure. So it started in September when the current prime minister passed these three farm laws that would essentially deregulate current agricultural laws in India. And it wasn't met with a lot of hope, and it wasn't met with kindness, because essentially by deregulating these laws, it would hurt a lot of the small farmers in India, which is a majority of the farming and the agriculture industry there. Protests started in September, and they really started getting larger, gaining more traction in December. And on India Republic Day, at the end of January, there were clashes between police officers and protesters and supporters. And I think since then, it's gained worldwide attention, especially because people like Rihanna have tweeted, Kamala Harris's niece, Mina Harris, Greta Thunberg, and a lot of other big name people. It's gaining a lot more attention worldwide. And even here in the States, we've had a number of protests in New York, California, DC, in support of the farmers from people in the diaspora.
And so the concerns are, there's economic concerns, certainly. These farmers say that, you know, their livelihoods are at stake. But there's also, as there are in some other countries, there's a bit of a suicide epidemic going on there as well.
Yes. So farming since the 1960s in India has declined, which has caused poor output of crops, which has caused farmers to lose a lot of revenue. Their inventory has gone down. Crops have been damaged because of the low quality of fertile soil. Like how it is here in America too, big big corporations and conglomerates are buying up all these small farms and putting people out of work. So Indian suicide rates have just exponentially increased over the past 2 years.
Wow, that's absolutely terrible. And now you mentioned that there's been international focus on this. Celebrities both inside and outside of India have been talking about this more. And it seems like the Indian government, police in New Delhi are not taking kindly to this new focus, and especially international outsiders, whether it's celebrities or activists like Greta Thunberg, they've reacted pretty poorly to that, right?
Absolutely. They see it as an attack on being Indian, being Hindu, more so than what it actually is, which is essentially a human rights issue that's going on in India right now. Since the protests have started, people have actually committed suicide during the protests. And it's hurt a lot of families who are trying to protest while trying to maintain their farm. People are sleeping in the streets. People are sleeping out in the cold. It's wintertime in India right now. So when India sees other people, sees quote unquote outsiders speaking against this, they see it as an attack on their democracy and attack on who they are as a country.
And there was we talked earlier on the show today about a protest, an activist, Disha Ravi, who was jailed a few days ago, and they're saying that she's seditious, that it's she's a traitor effectively. Are these serious charges? Is she in serious legal jeopardy as a result of this?
Absolutely. She is in serious legal jeopardy, and she is just one of many people who have been outspoken, have been protesting. Another woman, 20 years old, named Noldeep Kaur, is an activist, protested, also was arrested by the police, has been jailed. Her sister says that there's claims of sexual assault being done to her by the police. And it just doesn't seem to get any better, because there's no regulations against what charges are brought up against people. And you see this a lot of journalists were jailed for speaking out. Indian media ranks very poor on the Press Freedom Index. So whenever people are speaking out against this, they have to be fearful that they might have some sort of repercussions against them with the government.
So it's been going on for a few months, and you've mentioned how some of the violence has escalated. Do we have any way of knowing, other than the fact that more people seem to be paying attention, is it having its desired effect? Is there any indication that some of these regulation changes might be rolled back or adapted based on what the farmers have been saying?
Well, I think the protests are actually working in the sense that it's bringing attention and putting pressure on the Indian government. So what happened recently is Narendra Modi's administration pushed back the implementation of these laws for 18 months. They've tried to, well, they said they've attempted to meet with farm union leaders and people who are heading these protests to come to some sort of agreement. Now that hasn't gone through because the agreements don't seem to fit well with what the farmers and the protesters want. I don't know, being how Narendra Modi's government is, if they're actually going to roll back these regulations. But for right now, they've put a small Band-Aid on it. So there is some sort of pressure that's leading them to do this.
And any idea, have any of the leaders of the protests made clear, like, is this a thing that they're prepared to continue for a month, 6 months, even longer? Do we know where this might go from their point of view?
So these people are willing to basically die for this cause. They said either we're going to die at these protests or we're going to either die on our farmland, because they have no other options. There are no other options. These are not large farms where you have hundreds of acres that your yields of crops are so great that you can afford to take these risks. These are small farmers which India is made up of 60% of small farms. So these 1 to 2 acre farms, this is their whole entire livelihood. If they lose this, they're going to be put out of work, they're going to be starving, and they're not going to be able to provide for their family. So I don't think in their eyes there is an alternative action or an alternative course to take.
And I think that point that you make is very important. For people in America, we have this sort of myth of what farming is like, and largely it's been replaced by massive corporate farms. But that is still actually really like that. And so it's a very different situation. Sabrina, we really appreciate your work in this area and catching us up on this. I know you've been following the situation, and we look forward to seeing more of your work in this area in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.